all, this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
We're back. We're both back. It's been a while since we've both been back together here, Jason.
Where have you been, Wheeler?
Where have you been is the question. Oh, well, you know what? I was out more recently. You're right. I retreated to cooler confines over the past week or 10 days. Six, seven different states, all of which were way cooler than Texas.
Nice. You mean temperature-wise, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, what's cooler than Texas? Yeah, actually, they were cooler than Texas. They had cool mountains and valleys and all that.
I do remember seeing one of your social media posts. You were in South Dakota, up in the Black Hills.
Yeah, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, yeah. Utah, Idaho, all of those. Boy, it's a totally I was wearing sweaters.
Stop it, dude. Come
sweaters.
On.
Sweaters. I'm not kidding you.
As we record this, it's like 102 outside, and it's the heat index is 110, I believe.
It's just gross. So, you know what that is perfect for?
Cold beer.
Yeah, and especially the one I've got today. It's the Adios Pantalones, which is goodbye pants. And what makes this even, you know, more appropriate for this is a cerveza de sesión. Do you know what that is?
I don't. Go ahead and enlighten me, Mr. Espanol.
It is a session beer, and if you're not familiar with that, that means it is lower in alcohol by volume, and you know, I guess the theory is that that means that you can sort of have more of them as you go, because it's not having, you know, quite the punch, but it has a dual meaning because we are talking about a session today, so it totally fits.
Well, let's see how mine works out. I have Fallout.
Oh, Fallout's good.
Fallout.
That's appropriate for the subject today, too.
Manhattan Project Beer Company. I grabbed another beer out of the fridge, and I looked back there, and I saw I had Fallout. I'm like, let me grab this one, because I knew you'd be on top of it. So let's talk about the fallout from what the U.S. Supreme Court has been doing as I crack this thing open. But the U.S. Supreme Court has been all in the news here as they're wrapping up their session. And a number of rulings have come down. I believe we're expecting a few more here. But our guest is the guy we go to for all things legal. I think he's going to represent me when they come to pick me up for whatever they may get me on. But Steve Vladeck is with us again from the University of Texas at Austin. Steve, you aren't at the university where you have the books in the background.
No, speaking of getting away from hot Texas, we are up in Western Massachusetts, which is where we tend to, usually we go after the Supreme Court's done for the term. We went a week early this year, which means I'm getting to do all this fun stuff from the cool climes of the Berkshires.
And what is the climate there? What's the temp right now?
Right now it's 75, and sunny. So, jeez. You know, but I will say that, you know, we've been here about, I don't know, 6 days now, and this is actually the first day it hasn't rained. So, you know, feel a little bad for me.
Rub it in.
We don't
here.
Feel at all bad for you. And by the way, everyone who's listening, if you like to watch your podcasts instead of just listening to them, a lot of people apparently are into that. We do put these on YouTube, so you too can sit there and look at Steve Vladeck there in Western Massachusetts and just be filled with envy and maybe a little bit of anger
and the barrenness that is the walls of our office.
That's okay. Just search for Y'allitics on YouTube if you like watching these things instead. So, Steve, usually you wait until after the session is over. This one just, you know, and I know that they, you know, they can take till the end of June, I guess, into even July to announce all of these opinions. But this is really dragging out. However, they have the court has dropped some major rulings this time around. And I suppose the first one we should get into is on affirmative action, just because, you know, that one just happened. And this affects a lot of people and a lot of universities here in this country. They didn't completely get rid of affirmative action, but they did, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you know, where the court says one thing and does the other. This actually, you know, this is a real problem when we were trying to figure out the headlines, because, you know, I was helping the CNN folks figure out what our, you know, immediate banner is going to be. And there's a whole, you know, everyone's watching each other. So some of the websites are like, Supreme Court ends affirmative action, Supreme Court overrules affirmative action. We went with guts. We thought guts, the verb, yeah. You know, to gut was getting more at the heart of the opinion. And what's weird about it is that the Chief Justice's opinion for a 6-3 majority, you know, goes out of its way to not formally overrule the prior cases that had allowed racial preferences in higher education, but reconceives of them, reconstitutes them in such a way that going forward, it's going to be, you know, well nigh impossible for a university to actually have any kind of formal policy that gives a preference based on race. And there are these weird caveats where the Chief Justice says, you know, maybe in the applicant's personal statement, they can talk about how race shaped their personal experience. But of course, the university can't expressly credit that without running afoul of the majority opinion. And then he also carves out all of the service academies. So, you know, I guess the best thing that can be said is affirmative action tomorrow is not going to look anything like affirmative action yesterday. And affirmative action as we've known it for our lifetimes is dead. But, you know, the court has not completely closed the door on ever looking at all at racial status and minority status in evaluating an applicant. And so that's going to create all kinds of questions going forward. That's going to, you know, keep lawyers employed and everybody else banging their heads into the wall.
And of course, affirmative action goes back to the 1960s to President Kennedy, and it's opened doors for countless numbers of minorities to get into college. But a lot of people have complained, conservatives have complained for decades that it just hasn't been fair. You know, fast forward 55, 60 years here, and I'm curious just how far reaching this really might be, because in Texas, the only public university this really applies to is the University of Texas at Austin, which is the last one that still considers race. There are two private universities, Rice University in Houston, Southern Methodist University, SMU, in Dallas that considers it. But if it's not really considered that much, at least in college admissions in Texas, how wide-ranging is it, do you think, Steve?
I think it's wide-ranging, Jason, exactly because it's going to exacerbate the disparities between colleges in states like Texas and colleges in states in which it's still more widely permitted, if not actually affirmatively supported. And so I think we're going to see a growing gap in the ability of private schools especially, but some public schools in blue states to come up with some kind of program that at least mimics some of the effects of prior race-based affirmative action policies versus what we do at UT, you know, and what Rice does, et cetera. The other piece of this, though, I mean, I think this is a relevant part of the story. You know, one of the things today's decision also opens the door to is I think it opens the door to challenges to other forms of diversification initiatives on the ground that they're not overtly about race, but they're still sort of deliberately trying to create racial diversity in the class. And, you know, that's a charge that I could see someone trying to bring against UT's program, even after race is no longer expressly a variable, the 10% plan, right? It's a charge you could see in other contexts. So, you know, Jason, one of my concerns about the ruling, wholly apart from what it does to race-based affirmative action in the abstract, is that I think the court is also now inviting a new wave of litigation over policies that at least appear to be race neutral. And that, you know, the litigants might challenge on the ground that even though they appear to be race neutral, they were adopted for race-based reasons.
Professor, one thing that stood out to me just as a lay watcher of the Supreme Court is the opinions that came down on this, you know, the majority opinion, the dissenting opinions, and the fact that Justice Sotomayor read part of her opinion from the bench. Justice Thomas on the other side read part of his from the bench. They were even, you know, in the case of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, naming another justice in her opinion. Is that unusual for that sort of personal thing to be going on after a case?
So, you know, yes and no. I mean, parts of it are unusual, parts of it are not. It's not unusual in these kinds of high profile cases for the justices to get a little personal in their attacks with each other. What's unusual to me about what happened in the affirmative action cases is, you know, there are ways in which Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson are able to talk about the issue of race, you know, from personal experience and as members of a racial minority group that the rest of the court, you know, save Justice Sotomayor, are not. And, you know, I think one of the remarkable things that we saw in the affirmative action cases is you know, for the better part of really 30 years, Justice Thomas has been, you know, alone, has had sort of it all to himself to talk about how being a, you know, growing up as a poor Black man in the South, right, affected his upbringing and affected his attitude. And now we have Justice Jackson, you know, clapping back and saying that's one view of you know, racial segregation, of racial discrimination, but there's another view. And I was really struck by how both direct she was in confronting Justice Thomas, mm-hmm. and how sharp both of them were, right, in trading barbs with each other. And, you know, you mentioned Justice Thomas reading his concurrence from the bench and Justice Sotomayor reading her dissent from the bench. You know, that's something that is not typical. It is the rare case where a justice, other than the justice who writes the majority opinion, reads from the bench. I think that just underscores just how personal and how momentous, you know, the justices understood the affirmative action ruling to be.
You know what it made me think of, too, was that this court seems to be as divided as Americans are. You know, it, for a long time, of course, you know, you've had dissenters, you've had the majority, et cetera, on the court. But it seems like we're seeing that spill into the public a little bit more. And you do wonder, what is the personal working relationship like? Has that deteriorated, you know, when we look back over decades and decades of the court?
Well, and, we've, and, you know, I mean, race has always been a bit of a third rail for the court when it comes to this kind of question. You know, I remember back in 2007 when, you know, the sort of the what was then the new court with Justice Alito replacing Justice O'Connor effectively blocked the use of race as a tiebreaker in high school admissions in Seattle and Louisville. And, you know, Justice Breyer, who was not exactly one to throw bombs, read his dissent in that case, a case called Parents Involved, from the bench, and actually, you know, ad-libbed a line from the bench about how never in the law have so few changed so much so quickly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what that gets at is exactly your point, which is this is a topic that gets everyone's dander up, and that includes the justices. And I think the question is whether we are well served by having those kinds of divisions manifest as constitutional disagreements, as opposed to what really are, I think, in the main, you know, incredibly principled and just differently oriented policy disagreements about what is the best way forward for responding to, you know, the sort of lingering effects of a history of both de jure and de facto racial discrimination in this country. And, you know, folks are not going to agree on the answer to that question. That's as it should be. The question is whether, you know, it's better left to the political processes or whether we're better off having the Supreme Court resolve it once and for all.
Steve, one of our producers, Mike McCardle, came up with a pretty good question and brought up a point about what does this now do to historically Black colleges and universities? If minorities don't get accepted to these universities that have been carving out a place for them, does enrollment suddenly boost at HBCUs now?
It might. I mean, I think, you know, that's one thing to look at, right? Are we going to see, Jason, related to that, are we going to see efforts by some universities just to expand their enrollments, whether they're an HBCU or not, so that they can just admit more applicants without screening based upon these now prohibited criteria? So, you know, I think one of the things, everyone, I think, understood that whatever the Supreme Court ruled in these cases was going to have profound effects for the future of undergraduate admissions across the landscape. What I think is so exacerbating about the court's decision is that it's clear that there's a majority to excessively limit the use of race in admissions. But because the court doesn't go all the way to where Justice Thomas is, Jason, now we have questions. And now we have sort of matters for folks to hammer out, where the court, I think, could have perhaps provided more clarity.
Steve, so
Before we move on, let me ask one more question about this issue here. You mentioned a moment ago that universities might come up with programs to mimic affirmative action, maybe in legacy admissions for if your parent goes there. What other types of things could universities do to admit these minorities that might not have gotten in otherwise, and still not run afoul of the court decision?
Well, I mean, this is right. So I think the majority opinion leaves open the role of diversity statements in those contexts in which they haven't been forbidden by state law, right? So, you know, can a university say every applicant's allowed to append a diversity statement to their personal essay that talks about how their background shape their experience? And then can they rely upon that statement in making a admissions decision? The majority opinion says yes, and then elsewhere provides analysis that suggests that that would be problematic. So that's a puzzle. You know, we in Texas, of course, are familiar with the 10% plan, the idea of using geographic diversity as a proxy for, you know, racial and socioeconomic diversity. That's going to work better in some states than in others, you know, because of just the different ways in which folks have chosen to separate themselves or live together. You know, Jason, I think we're going to see just more efforts to find ways around this ruling that are inevitably going to be easier to implement in blue states and at schools with lots of resources, right? And harder to implement at schools that are in red states and that have fewer resources. And so I think that's one of the oddities of today's decisions. We're recording this on Thursday, right? One of the oddities of the affirmative action ruling is that it's going to, I think, exacerbate disparities between colleges on geographic lines and not just on sort of historical prestige lines.
Yeah, and as you mentioned just a few moments ago, we can expect plenty of lawsuits to continue coming out of this, challenging whatever universities come up with from here on out. Before we do move on to the next topic, I wanted to ask you one more on this one as well, because this is very personal, I would imagine, for you. You're on the front lines, you know. You're not only do you, you know everything about the Supreme Court and the Constitution, but you are a professor at a university. You see students from all walks of life and all races. How much have they been on your mind as you've been digesting the Supreme Court's ruling on this? And what do you expect to see going forward in real terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to separate them. And, you know, I think one of the best parts of my job is, you know, getting to meet every year a new group of diverse, and I mean that in every possible respect, entering law students. You know, I think, at the risk of being a bit of a cheerleader, I think the University of Texas has, at least for the last 25, 30 years, been a real leader when it comes to doing whatever it can to ensure that we are providing, you know, educational opportunities broadly, and trying to sort of generate as diverse a student body as we can. I was not paid to say that. but, you know, what I worry about is I worry about sort of two things. In the specific context of affirmative action, I worry about schools that haven't had that same historical success and that want to be able to contribute more to diversifying, you know, educational opportunity, but are now limited in the ways they can do that. I think that's a big problem. But the other piece, and you know, this is where I guess I get to be the anti-cheerleader. In a lot of respects, when I think about, you know, the future of public universities in Texas, you know, I think it's just as big a deal that the state legislature is making it harder for us to pursue these kinds of programs, right? That the state legislature is, you know, going out of its way to prohibit DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion practices and offices in our public universities. And I actually think, guys, that for us, the bigger short-term impact is going to come from what the state legislature did this session, especially SB 17, than from the affirmative action ruling. But that's, you know, back to the point about how different schools are going to experience this ruling differently based upon their geographic and political circumstances.
Well, good segue there, because I want to ask you about another issue, which I'm sure, which is where Wheeler was going to go next. Conservatives obviously elated at what happened today with gutting affirmative action. They've been trying to do it for decades, as we all know. But let's talk about the ruling on the independent legislature theory. We've talked about this before, but explain to our listeners and our viewers exactly what that is and why it's such a big deal that this conservative court went the other way and kind of sided with the liberal idea on this.
So, you know, this is an argument that was first, you know, brought into the mainstream in the litigation over the 2000 election in Florida. And it shows up in Chief Justice Rehnquist's concurrence in Bush versus Gore. And guys, the basic gist is to rely upon two different constitutional provisions, both of which give to the legislature of a state control over federal elections. So there's a provision in Article 1 that says the time, place, and manner of federal elections shall be set by the legislature of the state. There's a provision in Article 2 that says the president shall be elected by electors who shall be selected by whatever manner the legislature shall provide. The question these cases raise is whether when the Constitution refers to the legislature, it means the legislature to the exclusion of the state courts. And so in practice, if a state legislature says, here's our rule for this congressional election, and the state Supreme Court says, actually, no, that violates the state constitution, does that state Supreme Court ruling actually violate the federal constitution by taking away from the legislature the last word? Right? That's the independent state legislature theory. And what is remarkable about the Supreme Court's decision in Moore versus Harper is that the court put the kibosh on the broadest version of the theory, right? The notion that the legislature is always the exclusive dominant force when it comes to creating rules for federal elections. The court said, no, that's not true. But then the court, like, quite overtly refused to say, you know, when there will be, like, when state legislatures actually are allowed to go last, right? So the instead of saying the state Supreme Court can always override the state legislature, the Supreme Court said state Supreme Courts can usually enforce state constitutions against their state legislatures, but they can't go crazy. And the Chief Justice's opinion, guys, I love this because it's so transparently, transparent, right? The Chief Justice's opinion literally says, we do not identify where the line is. Like, wow. We are not saying here's the point past which the state court cannot go. We're just saying that the line exists and it's a thing. Wow.
So this is going to lead to more lawsuits too, isn't it?
And what's worse than that is it's not just more lawsuits, but guys, lawsuits that unlike this one, right, are going to come up in the throes of an election where, you know, the last thing we're going to want is the potential chaos. And we saw this in 2020. You know, some of the more extreme arguments in support of President Trump was tied, at least in some way, shape, or form, to this theory. So, you know, the sort of the headline that the court rejected the extreme version of the theory is correct. But in the process, the court sort of left open a soft version of the theory, right, for in extremist cases without telling us what makes a case an extremist. And I just have to say, like, from the perspective of, like, stability in the law and avoiding chaos in the next election cycle, it's actually, I think, not nearly as benign a result or benign a ruling as it could have and should have been.
Well, even though they didn't totally shut the door on this, though, I have, you know, seen others who said that this is, you know, the biggest federalism case in a long time, if not ever, one of the biggest cases for democracy. Is that too extraordinary? Is that too extreme? How important is this case? Was this the most important case this session?
You know, it's fun. It's such a good question. It really depends on what your baseline is, right? If the question is, what could the Supreme Court have done? Like, how much worse could it have been? Yes. I mean, in this case, the fact that the Supreme Court did not endorse the crazy version of the independent state legislature theory is great for democracy. It's really important. It would have been the most important ruling of the term if they had. But I guess, guys, the question is, do we really give out participation trophies to the Supreme Court? Like, hey, congratulations, you didn't blow up the country today. And I think, you know, we've become so conditioned to sort of be worried about the role the Supreme Court can have and just how far the court can go, that when the court doesn't happen to go there, we feel relief. But if you actually step back for a second, what the court did in Moore versus Harper is it actually, for the first time, turned, you know, the Chief Justice's concurring opinion in Bush versus Gore into the law of the land, and said, hey, there are going to be circumstances where the federal courts are going to be allowed to tell state courts that they're not allowed to enforce the state constitution against the state legislature. That's a remarkable holding. And I just think that, like, you know, the court could have made things so much worse. But this is not exactly good.
It's a good point. And for our listeners and our viewers who are on kind of the periphery of all this and maybe read headlines as they scroll through social media, you know, there was a lot of concern at the end of the Trump administration that Trump loaded the court with conservatives and that those conservatives are going to run roughshod over liberal ideas and moderate issues. But have we really seen that?
So, you know, Jason, it's a great question. I think the short version is it depends on the baseline, right? So, you know, I think one of the things we've seen this term is a bit of a split between Thomas Alito and Gorsuch on one hand, and the Chief Justice and Rob and Barrett and Kavanaugh on the other. You might sort of call that like the, you know, the sort of the Trump Republican mindset versus the Bush Republican mindset. Even though, of course, Thomas and Alito were not Trump appointees, but still. And I think we've seen a number of cases where the daylight between those two camps has come through. Not necessarily the highest profile cases, but, you know, there were a couple of rulings earlier this week and last week about the Texas's lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's immigration enforcement priorities, right, about Texas's challenge to the Indian Child Welfare Act, where we saw, you know, Barrett and Kavanaugh and the chief actually go with the Democratic appointees. So I guess, you know, the way I look at it is there's clearly now a majority of justices who are deeply in line with what I would have thought and, you know, what I sort of grew up learning of as mainstream Republican political and legal ideology circa 2000 or 2005, right? Circa the Bush administration. And where there's a gap, right, between the justices themselves and between the justices in the lower courts is on the more recent stuff, right, is on sort of the more aggressive pushes to toward deregulation, right, the more aggressive pushes toward the ability of states to challenge any federal policy under the sun.
And I guess, go ahead. Well, if this term is any indication, what does that say about the future, do you think?
I think it says that the Supreme Court is still the most conservative court we've seen in our lifetimes, but it's not as conservative as some of the, you know, most right-leaning judges who President Trump appointed. I think, right, it's not as conservative as the Fifth Circuit, the federal appeals court that covers Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. The Fifth Circuit actually has a really bad track record at the court this term. They've lost 6 of the 8 cases that went up. So, mm-hmm. Jason, I think what it says is, like, we've got a really conservative court, but not necessarily a, you know, nothing matters except win, hashtag winning court. And, you know, that's, I guess, again, back to participation trophies, right? Reassuring that there's not a majority for nothing matters except hashtag winning, but that still means a pretty big shift in the direction of American constitutional law, you know, for the near future.
Before we go to the next topic, Professor, I want to ask you, pull on that thread about the Fifth Circuit losing the vast majority of cases in this term that it had decided that went before the high court. Does that, in your experience, does that chasten a circuit court? Does it change how they do business going forward, or do they just keep on rolling?
So I think, circuit courts are they, not its, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. I think there are going to be some judges on the Court of Appeals who look at that and say, oh, maybe we've been a little bit too aggressive. And I think there are going to be some who are going to have the attitude that was, you know, famously attributed to the late Ninth Circuit Judge Stephen Reinhart, they can't reverse me all the time. right. But so I don't know that it's going to sort of rein in the Fifth Circuit. One of the things that's different about the Fifth Circuit's track record this term versus prior terms where it's been notable how bad like the Sixth Circuit or the Ninth Circuit did is no one on the court has called them out specifically or overtly, whereas we've seen that with other courts before. So, you know, I don't think the Fifth Circuit's going to wake up tomorrow and say, oh boy, we've been overdoing it. But I do think it's an important reminder that, you know, just because litigants can find a friendly district judge in Texas, just because the Fifth Circuit might, you know, allow a outlier type of ruling to remain in effect, like Judge Kaczmarek's ruling in the Mifepristone case, doesn't mean it's going to survive with this court, even with its composition, even with this solid 6-justice conservative majority.
And again, just for people who, you know, don't pay constant attention to this stuff, especially like you do, the Fifth Circuit is a very important thing here in Texas, because that is the circuit that hears these, you know, cases that are appealed that are decided here in Texas. And many of them, you know, even if they go away that somebody doesn't like, don't end up before the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court doesn't choose to pick them up. So their word in a lot of cases is the final word.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the federal appeals courts have the last word in, you know, well over 90% of cases in the federal courts. And, you know, a lot of that's not controversial, right? But, you know, some of that is. And it just goes to how we talk about the Supreme Court a lot, understandably, but the courts of appeals can often be just as important.
And before Wheeler hops into his next issue, I want to ask you about one you mentioned as well, and that's the Supreme Court decision in favor of Joe Biden being able to arrest and deport who he wants, kind of when he wants. How surprising was that to you? Because the dissent, I believe, was, you know, a single dissent. It was an 8-1 decision, I believe, and the dissent was it Alito saying that, you know, the expansion of presidential powers is going through the roof, something like that?
Yeah, it's funny how people's views change depending upon who's in the White House. So, you know, I was not surprised, Jason, only because the way the oral argument went in this case, I think, was very sort of suggestive of this result. You know, it's important to note the court did not say that the Biden administration enforcement priorities were fine. Right. What the court said was that Texas can't challenge them, that Texas and Louisiana lacked what we call standing. Right, to bring this case in the first place. And, you know, that's both a smaller ruling and a bigger one. Because, I mean, as you guys know, you know, Texas as a litigant, Ken Paxton, you know, before he was impeached, has been incredibly aggressive in it basically leading the charge against any number of Biden administration policies. Yeah. And the way that Texas has been able to do that back to the Fifth Circuit is because the Fifth Circuit has as generous a set of rules for when a state can challenge a federal policy as any court in the country. So it's actually relatively easier for Texas to challenge a federal policy in Texas than for California to challenge it in California. And so, Jason, one of the important things to me about the decision in the aptly but unhelpfully named U.S. versus Texas is that, you know, the court pushed back on this theory of standing. The court said, hey, you know, Texas, you don't have standing to challenge these enforcement orders because they're not affecting you, right? Or if they're affecting you, they're affecting you only incidentally and only in the ways that it affects any other state. You know, as we're recording this, we haven't yet seen how the court handles the student loan cases, but, you know, I'll be interested to see if the same skepticism of state standing dooms the challenges to the student loan cases, because the big suit in that case is by 6 red states led by Nebraska and Missouri. And Jason, to me, that's a big deal, not because it leaves in place this one particular immigration policy, but because it really suggests that lower courts, especially, again, lower courts in the Fifth Circuit, have been too willing to let Texas be the sort of the challenger of the day to all these policies, maybe in ways that are going to make it harder for Texas to be the plaintiff in all these cases going forward.
Let's talk about one more case, and this one didn't go down to the wire to the last minute, and it actually came in before you decamped there to Massachusetts, and that is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, surviving in that Alabama case where the maps were redrawn, this could have some significance here in Texas, couldn't it?
It sure could. I mean, so this one, I think this is probably one of the biggest surprises of the term. So this was a case about, you know, the congressional district maps that Alabama drew after the 2020 census. Alabama has 7 seats in the U.S. House, and the map that Alabama legislature initially drew had 1 seat out of the 7 that was a so-called majority-minority district, even though Alabama's population is 27% Black. Even though if you were going to do the math, you would think that would lend itself to 2 majority-minority districts. What's so revealing about this case is, you know, the lower courts in this case blocked the map and said, actually, under the Voting Rights Act, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in a 1986 case called Gingles, I love that case name, right? The lower court said, this actually violates the VRA. Hey, Alabama, you have to redraw your map. And a similar decision happened in Louisiana, a similar decision in Georgia. And the Supreme Court, guys, as you know, last year issued an unsigned, unexplained emergency order freezing those lower court rulings and allowing those states to use those maps in the 2022 midterm cycle. Well, it's remarkable now that the court says, actually, are bad, right? Those lower courts were right. These maps are unlawful, because what that suggests is that the, you know, these seats in the current Congress were actually drawn unlawfully. And if you do the math, you can actually get pretty close to Democratic control of the House of Representatives if the court had not intervened that way last spring. So it's surprising in 2 respects. One, it's surprising that this court would actually stand by one of its precedents when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, when it's been so hostile to the VRA in other contexts. Instead, here, Chief Justice Roberts, for a 5-justice majority, reaffirmed Gingles and the test for when you have to have majority-minority districts. But 2, it's remarkable because, you know, last year, it was a different 5-4 majority that let Alabama use this map. And the only justice guys who's in different places in the two orders is Justice Kavanaugh, who does not explain his change of heart, right? Who does not explain what changed between time one and time two. And so that's revealing to me both as an example of how important those emergency rulings can be, even when they're not explained, and of how they're not necessarily predictive, right, of where the court's going to end up on the merits in ways that now, as Jason, as you alluded to, is going to potentially empower, enable additional challenges to congressional maps in Texas, in Ohio, you know, in other, especially red states, where there really have been, I think, concerted efforts to minimize the electoral power of minority groups.
And that challenge has already been underway here in Texas. The question is, you know, how long is it going to take, though, even with this ruling, for that to come to a head as far as the case that's been moving forward here in Texas?
And back to the Fifth Circuit, you know, what's the Fifth Circuit going to, you know, how in a hurry is the Fifth Circuit going to be to, you know, extend that precedent into Texas? So, you know, I mean, I think we've already seen, I think it's the Cook Political Report has already changed its ratings for 7 House seats in the next cycle just based on this decision, because of its projections of how maps are going to have to be redrawn. If anything, guys, I think that's undercounting it. You know, I think there's a very good chance that reactions to this decision, if not in Texas, then at least in other states, could go a long way toward helping Democrats reclaim a majority of the House in 2024, which just goes back to the point about how big a deal it was that the Supreme Court intervened last term to allow these states to use these maps in the 2022 cycle.
Steve, I'm just thinking about something you said a moment ago to one of the questions, and the question was something about how whether the, you know, the Supreme Court has kind of put the Fifth Circuit in its place by just, you know, ruling against them so much. Does this mean that Texas will likely, I don't know if Texas will file less lawsuits against the federal government, but Texas might have less of a shot at going at the federal government?
Maybe. Or at least, Jason, that we'll see fewer cases where Texas is out on an island, right? And sort of, you know, a sort of a one state ban and pushing back. I mean, I think it remains to be seen. And frankly, again, I think, you know, the student loan cases that'll be out by the time folks are listening to this will have more to say about this, because either the court is going to go even further in reining in the ability of states to challenge federal policies in the Nebraska versus Biden case. Yeah. Or they're going to distinguish it and say, actually, here's the blueprint for how you do it. Jason, I think that's going to have a lot to say about how aggressive Texas is going forward and how much the lower courts in Texas and the Fifth Circuit, you know, allow Texas to pursue those challenges.
I want to ask you about something that's just been boiling beneath the surface of this particular Supreme Court session, and that is the ethics and all of these reports that have come out, particularly about Justices Alito and Thomas accepting gifts over the years, and you know, a lot of folks saying, hey, you know, all of the justices, the judges below you in the court systems in this country have a set of ethics and have to adhere to a certain set of rules, and it seems like you don't, and yet you're just sort of policing yourselves, and critics say you're not doing a good job of policing yourselves. I know that you've been, you know, very outspoken about this, and I saw a tweet the other day where you said that you've just been mortified by the reactions that you've gotten just by even raising the issue of, you know, imposing a code of ethics on this nation's highest court. These people are, you know, in their positions for life.
Well, and I think, guys, this goes back to me what is the biggest theme of the term, which is not about any of these merits rulings. If you look at what makes the current court different from its predecessors, it really is not any of these decisions. It's not a conservative majority. We've had that at various points in the past. It really is, more holistically, the sort of general lack of accountability, the extent to which the court is not beholden to Congress and doesn't think it ought to be beholden to Congress.
Or to precedents really in some cases.
It's right. And you know, that, guys, I mean, that's a departure from historical understandings. I mean, for the first 200 years, you know, there was this ongoing back and forth dynamic where Congress would use various tools to exert leverage over the court when the court was, you know, in Congress's view, getting too far out of line from what Congress thought it should be doing. Congress would cancel a term. Congress would take cases off the docket. You know, Congress controlled where the justices sat. Congress made the justices ride around the country for 100 and some odd years, right? I mean, so we've gotten away from that in the last 35 years. And I think a big part of the, you know, the broader disease that all of these little data points are symptoms of, including the ethics kerfuffles, is just the notion that the court is not just independent, but, you know, unaccountable to the other branches to a degree we haven't seen before. And then, frankly, guys, to a degree that I think is unhealthy. And so for me, you know, part of the question is whether you like the bottom lines of these rulings or not, can't we all at least agree that there ought to be a stronger dynamic where the court is one of three branches in our federal system and not the dominant one, and where there are mechanisms by which, you know, the people can actually exert leverage over the justices when we believe that they're acting inappropriately. That, I think, is a conversation we have to have. It's hard to have in the moment, right, when these big decisions are coming down and it's all everyone wants to talk about.
Steve, what would have to happen, though, for that to actually be implemented, for Congress to do something?
I mean, Congress has to pass a law. And, you know, I mean, Jason, Congress has a lot of tools at its disposal. Congress controls the court's budget other than the justices' salaries. Congress controls the court's docket. It's just, you know, given control of that to the court, Congress could take some of that back. So, Jason, I think it's about changing the political dynamic where, you know, I don't mean we as in the three of us, but like we as in, you know, those folks who care about the court, push Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, to think that it's part of Congress's job to exert institutional authority over the court, not because we want the court to behave differently in particular cases, but because we want the court to be part of our system and not aloof from it. And I think that's, you know, that's a conversation that I hope we can keep having as we turn toward, you know, the cases that the court will take next term.
Steve, we can't let you go today without giving you the opportunity to give a shameless plug. We should have done this in the beginning for Shadow Docket, your new book. I believe it's a bestseller pretty quickly, too, isn't it?
That's what they tell me.
Okay.
Congratulations, man.
Tell us
about
that.
Buying all those copies with my political action committee really worked out well for me.
Hey, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Yep. Tell us a little bit about that. And for people who, you know, that they might think, oh, Shadow Docket, I don't know anything about that. You know, it's how easy of a read it is.
I mean, I wrote it for my mom, but I wrote it for, you know, non-lawyers who want to know more about the court. And it's, you know, a lot of it is history. A lot of it is sort of putting the current court in context. And it's a book that is really designed to help, exactly to our last, you know, the last question. It's a book that's really designed to help folks understand the court more holistically. How did the Supreme Court come to play such a big role in our lives? How much of this is new? When did things change? You know, and what is it specifically about the current court that's so problematic? You know, even though everyone knows my politics, I'm a progressive, I don't think the problem is, you know, decisions like Dobbs or the affirmative action case or Bruin, right? I think the problem is the broader accountability gap and understanding how we got to that point, understanding why we got to that point, understanding why that point is why this is a bad place to be in, whether you like what the court is doing or not, is the goal of the book. And I hope folks will check it out.
And folks can find the book where? Amazon?
Amazon, bookshop.org, tinyurl.com/shadowdocket if you really need a more specific ping. Available where fine books are sold.
Where fine books are sold. Hey, but before we let you go, I do want to ask you about the Ken Paxton impeachment, since Paxton has been at the center of you know, all lawsuits filed in Texas against the federal government. Are you watching this? And what do you think happens in the impeachment trial? Because it's mired in politics. It's steeped in politics with the Senate being the jurors. What happens when this goes to trial in September?
I mean, you guys are, I should ask you guys that question because it's more
I don't know,
you than
man.
Me.
We're asking you. I have no idea. I don't know.
All I can say is, you know, color me skeptical that the Republicans in the Texas House and Senate woke up one day and realized that Ken Paxton is Ken Paxton. And so, you know, what's going to happen when the trial takes place? I think that's really, that goes more toward why is it now that the Republican-controlled House and Republican-controlled Senate are going after Paxton and who's behind it? And if you guys know the answer to that, man, we have this podcast totally backwards. I should be interviewing you.
We'll write a book about it.
There you go.
Last little piece on that, though, when we were speaking with the attorneys who are handling the case on behalf of the Texas House, they sort of let it slip that, you know, the investigating committee there in the House that has, you know, pulled up all of this investigative material on Paxton has been, you know, in touch back and forth with federal investigators who, of course, have been looking into Paxton for some allegations while he was in office. Do you think that the feds, I mean, a lot of people have wondered what has taken the feds so long to bring a case, if they're going to bring a case right here. Does this open the door a little bit when you start to see movement with impeachment and with his other case on securities fraud? Is it possible that we see some momentum build there?
You know, it's certainly possible. It could be also that it's actually developments in the federal case that pushed, you know, folks in the Texas House to get moving finally after all this time. All I can say is I suspect that a year from now, we will have a better sense of why this happened now. I just remain very skeptical that it's because one day everyone woke up and realized who Ken Paxton was. You know, seems to me that this is about something that is at once more personal and perhaps more problematic for Texas Republicans in the long term if they continue to have Paxton as the sort of, you know, leading sort of figure in that party. But what that is, we can only speculate.
Okay, so you say we may know more a year from now. We're going to set a date to rejoin you a year from now. You know, maybe we can all be there in Western Massachusetts together.
I love
for
it.
That one.
We have beer up here too.
Steve, thank you so much as always. Always great to pick your brain on all of these topics.
It's great to be with both of you guys. Talk to you soon. Have a great summer.
Thanks, you too.